All right, welcome, everyone, to our regular board meeting of Tuesday, April 16th, 2019. Glad to see everybody. We met during closed session from 3:30 to 6 p.m., and we had a board member, Walt Millar, participating via teleconference at that meeting, although he is not here during closed session this evening. We discussed the public employee performance evaluation of our superintendent. We had a conference with labor negotiators and conference with legal counsel regarding existing litigation. So that's our announcement of closed session items. I will ask if we have a consensus on the order of business for this evening's meeting.
Yes.
Doing good? Thank you. And then we have some minutes to approve. First is our minutes of March 14, 2019. Any changes? If not, if someone could make a motion, that would be lovely. I will make a motion to approve the minutes of March 14, 2019.
I'll second.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None. Okay, Mr. Unger is abstaining, so we have five yes, one abstention, one absence. Mrs. Campbell, motion by me. Second by Mrs. Roger. Okay, next we have approval of the minutes of March 19.
I move approval of the minutes of March 19th.
I'll second.
All right. We have a motion by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, a second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Once again, one absence. Everyone else is a yes. Approval of minutes of April 8, 2019.
I move approval of the minutes of April 8,
2019.
Okay, we have a motion by Dr. Eisenrath Rogers, a second by Ms. Frame. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. And again, Mr. Millar is absent. Everyone else approves. And last but not least, approval of the minutes of April 11, 2019.
So moved.
Okay, we have a motion by Mr. Unger, a second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. And
Mrs. Schaffer?
Yes.
I may need to withdraw my second on the minutes of March 14th. Am I correct that I missed March 14th and 19th due to bereavement? Okay. I'm sorry, I have to withdraw that second.
Okay, so on March 14th, so I made the motion, so I can't second it.
Second.
All right, so we will replace Mrs. Roger with Dr. Eisendrath Rogers on the second. All right, moving.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. No,
you're
fine.
I'll have to withdraw my approval of those 2 minutes. Yeah, I know, it's wacky. I'll have to withdraw my approval of the minutes of the 14th and the 19th as well.
Okay. We are all official now. Thank you for remembering that. Now we will move on to student presentations to the board.
Hi, I'm Annalise from Morro Bay High School, and I'm here to update everyone on what we've been up to. So this month we have an event coming up that we've never done before. It's going to be a fundraiser for our ASB as well as our school clubs. It's going to be called Morropalooza, and it will be a sort of carnival music festival type of event. It's going to be from 4 to 8 p.m. on Friday, April 26th. So 2 Fridays from now, I believe, and there will be the local bands there, such as Oso Soul and Absolute Zero, as well as student performers. Food trucks are coming out. Kiwanis Club is going to be barbecuing and selling things there as well, and there will be student club booths. So we're hoping to just have community members and family members and students come out and have a nice evening and fundraise for our ASB. And then as well this month, for the students, we have a kickball tournament coming up. On April 22nd is Earth Day, so we're going to be adding to our science garden at lunch. Students will be planting several items there. In addition to that, we're also this month starting a fundraiser for the nonprofit Gravity Water. Several other schools in the district, such as Slo High, have just completed a fundraiser for this nonprofit as well, I believe. They provide water filtration systems for disadvantaged schools in places like Nepal. I believe they're starting in Puerto Rico and South America. It's a really good nonprofit, and so we're really excited to fundraise for them. And then May 2nd at 5:30 p.m. is going to be Morro Bay's open house, and that's open to the community as well. And we will be showcasing our brand new J-Wing facility there, so it's going to be really exciting.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. As always, you are welcome to stay, but we understand that you may have other priorities and commitments. So thank you for your report.
Annalise, have you decided where you're heading next fall?
Yeah, I'm officially committed to Santa Barbara.
All right. Yay.
All right, our next agenda item is 5.02, Los Sosos Middle School Program Highlights. Mr. Mayfield.
I'd like to introduce Mr. Wilcox, and he's going to let us know what he's been up to here at Los Sosos Middle School.
Mr. Wilcox is always up to something, so let's hear.
Does my reputation precede me?
Wait a minute. Yes,
it does. Do I really need this microphone? I like this.
Better than your teacher voice?
Is it better than my teacher voice? Let's check and see.
Is it lower than my teacher voice?
It's a pleasure, folks. Thank you for the opportunity to present. This is a publication, shall we say, and it delves into careers, students, and this district. But the first three words out of my mouth really aren't what you just heard. It has to do with relevance, rigor, and relationships. I think I've heard that someplace before. But I want to connect it, that is, bring it together, the nexus of three other words. And that would be precision, perseverance, and, most importantly, perception. So as we examine careers, and this publication is showing before you on the screen, I happen to have brought along two authors that wrote articles for the publication. It's called URGENT. URGENT is an acronym. You are gonna explore new technologies.
Ah,
that's what that's all about. Yes. And, oh, it says it right there, too. What do you know? And so with that in mind, it truly is, and in all seriousness, I have to say, this is very urgent that as humans we understand this interface with technology. What used to be, and I'm sad to say as an example, I heard, and I'm sure you did, about Notre Dame. And that structure has burned to where it's going to have to be, you know, lots of years of reconstruction to get it back. But it took 200 years to put it together. Let's put this in perspective. The technology that was used 800 and some odd years ago, and now let's flash forward to today, what it's going to take in millions of dollars, and look at the technology that the folks right here, the students that we are engaged with, are going to face as far as learning how to, and I'm going to quote something I learned way back in high school. It has to do with this guy named Alvin Toffler. It's not the, and I see somebody nodding already, you've heard this before, the illiterate of the 21st century aren't going to be those that can't read or write. It's going to be those that cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn. That's the key essence of technology and change. And change is that part that nobody likes. I like to say that the only person that likes change is a baby. And they're changed in their diaper, they're happy, they're not crying. But when it comes down to it, the reality of this publication focuses on this particular issue, and it's a monthly publication, is women. And when I said perception, in the tech world, oftentimes women have been relegated to less pay, less authority and power in their positions. And so with that in mind, all of the articles, it's approximately 12 pages long, feature and highlight women in professions that connect to our world. So with that in mind, could we proceed, and thank you very much, Mrs. Campbell. So there's a quick understanding of what this publication, how it's laid out. You can click on, let's take Odd World, for instance. If you click on that, that's going to immediately take you to the story here. And once upon a time, and I'm a history kind of guy, and I know I don't see that little digit or timer going, so I know I have 5 minutes, but I'm going to make it quick as possible here. Okay? So basically, the person you see in the lower right-hand corner there, Sherry McKenna, I took students to Odd World, which is above Rossville and San Luis, way back in the days before Google, as it says in the article. Some of you remember Odd World. Well, she was a pioneer. Way before Google thought about those things, about having employees where they get their dry cleaning done, they have chefs waiting on them. Way before that, the first thing we saw was a pool table, an environment that was conducive to workers learning and producing a product. So this is an example of someone local. They have since moved to the Bay Area, and they're back in action again still with, again, it's a video game, Odd World. If we could click to the next page, there we go. I'd like to highlight the works of the students I brought along with me. First is Maddie Alvarez. Maddie, could you come over here and just quickly sum up what you did there?
So I decided to write an article for this magazine after Mr. Wilcox approached me with it. And I chose medical technology and technology that has to do with careers that lead into patient care, because that's something that I'm personally interested in. And I found it fascinating how medicine went from herbal remedies to robots performing surgery. And that was a big point that I touched on in this. And then I also touched on the fact that professors and teachers, the majority, when they're talking about the future, talk about their own personal experiences and how that doesn't necessarily make sense, because the future is changing and experiences generations apart are just going to confuse students. Thank you.
Thank you. And if we could switch to next page, please. And then one more page. There we go, at the back. And this is Reese Demarest, and she's going to comment about her particular article she's written.
Hello, I'm Reese Demarest, the author of this particular article. And I wrote about how education has been severely changed and affected by technology in an absolutely amazing way, and how that's affected my education. For example, I talked about how augmented reality has actually become a fairly big part of projects that I've been doing in school, and specifically last year we were shown a AR image of the first printing press, and it was on the table. I could look at it through the device, and it was just on the table, and it was moving like a printing press would when it was invented, and that was super cool to me, and that was the first time I'd ever really interacted with augmented reality, and that totally changed my education and the way that it worked and how I thought about things. And we've been continuing to use augmented reality and other types of technology throughout my education, and even smaller stuff, like I say in my article, handwriting. We were taught for one brief year pretty much how to write in cursive. But after that, it wasn't exactly pushed as much because everything was digital, so I forgot how to write and read effectively in cursive. And so when I get holiday cards from family members, I can't read them as well, and I have to sort of struggle through it a little more. And so that was really interesting. And it's just crazy because when I was young, we didn't have computers and iPads and all technology in classrooms. It was pencils and paper. And now in almost all of my classrooms, on a day-to-day basis, I use a computer where I use Google Documents and Google and all these types of different programs for my education. And that's just totally blown my mind in the way that from elementary school to even just now, I'm not nearly done with my education. It's changed so much. So that's what my article was about. Thank you.
Very nice, Reese. And I'll quickly sum it up because 5 minutes, brief. But basically, the idea of AR, augmented reality, is presented in this publication, and it's repeated as far as the theme, but I declared this year in my classes is the year of augmented reality. I arranged so that Google could do a demonstration, which they were able to take advantage of last year. But the notion of having a QR code, which is a bunch of little squares, you guys have seen these before probably, you aim your phone at it, and then suddenly up pops an object, such as a printing press maybe, and you can rotate around in three dimensions and see what it looks like and examine it closely. And that alters your consciousness. It changes your ability to retain information in ways that don't exist in paper. And I love paper, by the way. But I've gone from dittos to digital in my career. And I can tell you that these folks are in for exciting times. It's a very positive future that they're looking forward to. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. That was a very interesting presentation, and I had read the newsletter prior to the meeting and really appreciate it, your work. So thank you. All right. Next we have item 5.03, Board Priority 1, LCAP Focus Area 3, the Common Ground draft recommendations.
Yes, so I'm very pleased to and grateful that we're able tonight to hear the recommendations from the Common Ground Advisory Task Force that just completed their second full year of meetings with myself and Mike Smith and our attorney. And the Common Ground Advisory Task Force originated out of a crisis. And it was from that crisis over 2 years ago, and I call it a crisis, but it was. It was a very difficult time where First Amendment rights and what a teacher can say and what a student can say within the school parameters are very complex and required some unraveling and some analysis. And it was confusing to our community. So from that crisis, we formed the Common Ground Advisory Task Force. And the Common Ground Advisory Task Force represents community and staff leaders who represent and come from very different places in our community, but all of them are leaders and highly respected individuals. And what we do is we bring very challenging conversations to these meetings and to this group. And I cannot say enough about how far we've progressed, what I have personally learned, and what I hope to continue to learn in the future. So I am grateful to introduce two representatives of 23 total representatives of this team. I'm going to introduce them in a second, and I'm very grateful that they came here tonight to share their recommendations to me, and hopefully those recommendations will then find their way into our LCAP, into the board's priorities, and as we evolve the Common Ground group into the years to come, I think you'll find that they are a highly engaged, collectively wise group of citizens and leaders in our community. And for that, I'd like to introduce Ms. Robin O'Leary. She represents Congregation Beth David. She is the office manager, but here's the thing. She's also a parent in our community. She has children who attend San Luis Obispo High and Laguna Middle School. And she is a former teacher in our district as well. So she's got a lot of stories to tell, a lot of great experiences, and I'm super glad that she's with us tonight. I also would like to introduce Father Ian Dellinger. He is a priest for St. Stephen's in Episcopal Church in San Luis Obispo. They both are remarkable people, and I'm glad they're willing to come out to Los Osos tonight to share the recommendations to me.
Hello, and thank you for your very kind words, Dr. Prater. I wanted to also add that besides being the office administrator at Congregation Beth David, I'm a longtime congregant and member of the Jewish community. So, and I also, I know I speak for all of us on the Common Ground Task Force, would like to thank Dr. Prater for his vision in putting this together. It's been a remarkable process over the past 2 years, and I know that the collaboration that has come together, the diversity that has come together in one room, I think it's been very positive and will be a very wonderful beginning for the district to make some positive change. So the purpose of the Common Ground Task Force is basically, it's designed to proactively provide the superintendent with a sounding board for finding common ground suggestions through civil discourse on controversial issues that impact students, provide specific suggestions to improve program, policy, and practices as they relate to these issues, and provide suggestions that will improve conditions on campuses for all students. And I think that's the key factor right there. When we met, Dr. Prater wants to make sure that every student that steps on campus doesn't that feels welcome and feels like they have a voice. And so in order to do that, we came up with these suggestions.
So our first recommendation is to develop curriculum that supports inclusivity. And this was a lot of conversation around this. So the first bullet point is to ensure that students take courses about different cultures and religions and or integrate into current curricula. Examples include, but not limited to, gender spectrum, ethnic studies, world religions, cultural diversity, and civil discourse. And those subjects, not all inclusive subjects, run throughout all of the recommendations, not just this one specific one. To require a diversity course as a graduation requirement, teach principles of civil discourse in an age-appropriate manner so you can start with primary all the way up to secondary. See footnote one for any notes about that. Create, improve, and improve the public process for accepting or denying supplemental curriculum and materials that encourages community input prior to adoption. Ensure that the district's primary and supplemental books and materials are culturally responsive and reflect an inclusive view of the world community. When books and materials do not meet these standards, provide guidance to teachers around how to supplement existing texts. And consider a peer communications class at the secondary schools.
Our second focus was to provide ongoing professional development that supports inclusivity and a culture of care. So we came up with developing standards expected of students and staff, and then conduct student and staff bystander training to promote inclusivity for a culture of care. Train administrators, teachers, and counselors in civil discourse facilitation skills so that teachers serve as educators, not simply conveyors of their personal perspectives. And examples of staff professional development to promote inclusivity and understanding include, but are not limited to, the gender spectrum, ethnic studies, world religions, cultural diversity, and civil discourse.
The next one has to do about the day. Restructure the instructional day to promote inclusive dialogue. Train and encourage counselors to meet with students in small groups to create a safe space for inclusivity discussions using principles of civil discourse. And create an advisory period or opportunity periodically throughout the year, example, student professional development days, to discuss relevant issues that affect campus life. At elementary schools, ask teachers to incorporate these opportunities.
Hiring practices, we ask that Dr. Prater look at engaging hiring practices that support inclusivity. And while we realize that the staff reflects the county norm, we would like to look a little broader for that and appreciate that he is very open to this. Number one was creating, recruiting, interviewing, and hiring practices that support or include result in a more diverse staff. Develop practices to hire staff with bilingual skills. Assess if student-to-counselor ratio is adequate to ensure a student's social, ensure student's social and emotional needs are met, primarily at the secondary level. We were talking about that. And create hiring incentives in light of the cost of living up here.
Our next recommendation is to promote student clubs, events, and opportunities that encourage inclusivity. So we suggest that we better inform students about existing clubs on campus and how to create desired clubs, including at the middle schools with an emphasis on unrepresented student populations and support for inclusivity. To promote inclusivity, encourage clubs to work together on joint activities and hold campus events that promote diversity and inclusivity.
And our final recommendation was to evaluate and reward inclusive behaviors with both staff and students. So evaluation should include ongoing identification of best practices, find ways to affirm progress on matters of inclusivity, and regularly and consistently evaluate the effectiveness of the district's efforts to create a more inclusive environment.
Thank you. I'm aware of the work that went into this and the time for this group of people to take from already full and busy lives to devote to this really important effort that we as a board and as a district are taking very seriously. So, yeah, thank you very much. All right, the next item on our agenda is correspondence, and at the time of publication of the meeting agenda, the board had received no correspondence as a board, I believe. Let me make sure. Yeah, no official correspondence had been received. Next is the time for public comment. If anyone wishes to address the board on an item not on the agenda, now's the time to do so. If you wish to wait until the agenda item is presented, you may do so at that time. Seeing no one, we will move on to the business and budget update.
Yeah, so it's actually been a little while since we had a board meeting, and Mr. Bonin and myself had the opportunity to attend the Safe Schools, their first ever conference. And so this is a group, actually two mothers that unfortunately had children that died in the Sandy Hook tragedy. And they've put together this cadre of professionals, educators, people in the field to really focus on school safety. And so this was the first time they'd actually had a conference. Uh-huh. And it was probably the best conference I've ever been to. I mean, they really did a great job of, they shared their story, which of course was heartfelt and teared up, and actually the principal of Columbine was there with one of the students with the tragedy, and so it was, and again, it was kind of an interesting dynamic in that they didn't focus on the negative of what happened, but more of, hey, how can we make things better. And so we walked away from that. Chris and I got a lot of information. If you've been by the superintendent's office, I've kind of jotted everything up on the board. And it's really that our focus on really developing a comprehensive safety plan, right? One that does focus on the safety plan itself and kind of what happens after tragedy and making sure we're prepared, those types of things, but really focusing on the items that are going to ensure that the tragedy never happens. Right, so the mental health aspects and the bully button, the concern button, and having all those things in place. So we've started as a district, but there's just still more to do, and to make sure that everyone is on the same, kind of on the same place and understanding. So again, a lot of great information came out of that conference that I think is going to help guide us. So we're looking forward to the SROs coming on board with us. And helping us with those and really getting all the agencies together to move forward and for us to work with our staffs and kind of moving forward. So there'll be more that we'll present to the board, kind of where we're at in terms of what we learned and kind of where we need to go in those six areas. As we know, school safety is, of course, very important to us.
Was one of the people, Michelle Gay?
Yes.
Yeah,
she's fantastic. Again, another kudos to Chris Bonin and his staff that over spring break, ton of projects getting done from asphalt repair to roofs to, just lots and lots that get accomplished whenever people are away. And so they've been kind of working their tails off as that's come through. He does have he worked with an energy group to kind of look at all of our energy kind of use and break that down, and so I'm going to have Chris present that to the board soon in terms of have that group come out and kind of share their information about it, which is very important, I think. And then kind of the last thing for me is we are deeply involved in staffing right now, so really looking at all the staffing at our sites. It's our principals
you know, they want to get people hired as quickly as possible, right, so that we have the best selection, the best teachers possible that we can get in front of our kids. So we've done a lot with that, really focused on, and again, Kim and I going around to the LCAT meetings, heard from a lot of teachers about the importance of class size and inclusion of special education students. And so we're really trying to make sure that we take that into account, especially at our Title I sites across the district. So I think at the current standpoint right now, we're adding about 4 teachers in elementary at those Title I sites. We have this bubble going through San Luis Obispo High School, so 3.5 extra teachers there to kind of help with that, which is tough, of course, as we are dealing with all the construction on that campus. And then we've also added some special education teachers for next year to kind of keep those caseloads and stop people from having to travel and move as much too, which of course just provides more instructional time. So those are things we've been working on. Kind of the last piece of that will be next week when we have the Pacheco lottery. That'll kind of give us our final, hey, where are we at, you know, in terms of how things are going to go. And I feel like we're in a really good place in terms of now and allowing for a little bit of growth room as schools have kindergarten roundups and things like that over the next month or so.
Great. Thank you very much. Educational services update.
I have a couple things to update you on today. First of all, the Equity Institute did wrap up on Friday. I want to say it was an incredibly productive, really thought-provoking time that we had a lot of participants from our school district, but as well as some of our surrounding districts. So it was a great example of different people coming together for kind of putting our brains together for a good purpose of thinking about our equitable practices within all of our school districts. One of the things that I wanted to just bring to your attention is that when the presenters left to do this, all over California and beyond, they felt that it was the most comprehensive school district commitment to an equity cause that they had been around. And so I think I, applaud you and Dr. Prater for that commitment. And also Mr. Mayfield for setting up really a wide range of stakeholders that were attending there, because it wasn't just, a certain group or a small group. There were board members attending, Rick and I attended. There were teachers, counselors, a range of stakeholders, which I think really does help not just change them professionally, but helps them to go out to their different groups and begin to continue that work at a deeper level. So really great experience. And know that it's just, one piece of the larger equity plan puzzle, but I know that it's helping us to continue to move in a great direction. Wanted to let you know about that. Also, some really great things happening with the foundation, some amazing work taking place there. They have decided to put together kind of an opportunity kind of fund is kind of one of the ideas. They formed, first of all, a task force around testing. So that was one thing that they looked at, tests related to either career technical education or college-bound students that they may need to be, families may need to be paying for tests. So think things maybe ACT, SAT, CTE certification if they wanted to be, let's say, OSHA certified or things like that, where students may need to pay for those tests. And although there are fee waivers, that means that students have had to have turned in a free and reduced lunch form, which, as we all know, that tends to start to dwindle as students are in high school. And plus, just with the high cost of living of where we live, that, they may not always qualify for a fee waiver, although paying a $94 test fee each time can be a real burden on, all types of families. So I think it's a really neat task force. Again, a lot of volunteers giving their time to put their heads together and think about great things to do for kids. So it's a real inspiring group to be around, and lots of great work happening there. So just a good update there. And I will leave the other LCAP update information to the presentation today.
Thank you. And this would be an opportunity to thank our board members, Marilyn Roger and Mark Buckman, who are have been attending the equity events on behalf of the board, and Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, who serves on the foundation as the board representative. So thank you for this, devoting your time to those efforts. All right, Measure D update.
Yeah, so again, kudos to Rick and staff. So Morro Bay High, if you've seen the front of the school, we have the new Student Support Center coming up. And it's really, despite the rain, that project has continued in force, which is exciting, right? And that, again, all these projects now will facilitate the movement of students and classrooms and continuing all the projects. I did send the board kind of a map of both campuses and Friday notes, and once you see like all the work that's going to be done, it pretty much encompasses the entire campus at both Morro Bay and, mm-hmm. and Slough High. So it's exciting as we move forward and really getting some momentum with projects moving forward. So again, we'll be later tonight wrapping up the J-Wing, which is exciting and great to hear Annalise talk about the open house and getting students in there. They have had some students in there right now, so Brady Halverson in particular has been working with the kids, and so it's classic. They set up this robotics room. They had two mats, one blue, one black. The students went up to the teacher and said, "Hey, listen, wouldn't it be cool if we used our new laser cutter and we did an MB in blue and an MB in black, and then we just basically popped them out and put them in the other ones, right?" And so they did it. The kids walked over, did it. It fit perfectly. It looks fantastic. And so it's the stuff that they're – I mean, I'm a little nervous about what the supply budget's going to be for those classes. So they're going to – we'll have to work on some fundraisers for those things. But, again, the teacher has just been unbelievable in, I mean, taking welding classes on his own and doing lots of things to ensure that those kids are ready to go and really utilize that whole space. Very exciting for us. At Slough High, it's – finally, the rain has stopped, so we're starting to see some progress, right, with the pool and the student support services building there, too. We have the newer gym. We say new gym. It's 1970s, right, but it's the new gym. GMP, so we could start that project. Short window over the course, mostly during the work during the summer, right, in terms of use for that facility. And next, the design-build projects, both at Morro Bay High School as well as some of the projects at San Luis Obispo High School are moving forward. And so we expect to have those in the coming months and really interested to see what, again, like we said before, those budgets, how they come in. And at our next study session, I'll be kind of giving the board an update on the overall Measure D budgets to date. Lastly, Kelly Lee, I can't tell you how huge she has been through this bond process. And really the paperwork side of things. So getting that matching grant for Bellevue Santa Fe, so the $2.6 million so that we get all that work done on that site, we couldn't have done it without her doing everything and keeping track of it all. And I mean, the state regulations and process are unbelievable, the hoops they make you jump through to do anything. And so the great news we got was we get, you know, the state likes to give you all these approvals and tell you you're going to get this money, but they don't tell you when you're going to get it, right? So you might get a CTE grant and not get it for another 10 years, modernization, those types of things. But in this particular case, with those Bellevue monies, we just got word that we should be receiving those in June, which is fantastic because it's the same fiscal year. It's going to make things so much easier for our fiscal staff in terms of following up on that. So, again, kudos to her and to the staff for ensuring that we got those extra dollars to maximize what we're able to do with Measure D.
Please convey our thanks to Kelly Lee. Yeah, that's great. Thank you. All right, next we have a resolution.
So yeah, as we've shared with the board before, the lease-leaseback process for our lease-leaseback projects, you enter into a lease with the contractor, they complete the project, and when the project is completed, we do still have a warranty on the work. So even though tonight I'm going to ask the board to, in the lease, basically kind of take the property back for the school district so that we can use it with our students, we still do have warranty on those work, right? So if anything comes up, having that great relationship with our contractor currently, I think, is an important thing. Talked to Mr. Holcomb about this a little bit and some questions that Mr. Sheffer had about, you know, kind of, okay, what happens now when we vote for this? Are they, you know, kids haven't been in it. What if things are wrong? What if something happens? So having that warranty in place is definitely something that is very important for us as we move forward. And then there's also, they actually have manufacturer warranties. So 30 years on the roof, or you know, different products and things like that are all part of you know, the warranties that go along with construction projects. So in this case, what I'm asking the board to do is to pass the resolution tonight. Later on in the board agenda, you're going to see a couple other items in terms of quit claiming and terminating the lease itself, but it has to start with the resolution at this phase.
Thank you. Is there anyone from the public who would like to address us on this? All right, we'll come back to the board, and I would like to thank Mr. Holcomb and Mr. Pinkerton for responding to my questions about warranties of materials and workmanship. So we need a motion or any discussion from the board.
I was just going to say, I was just telling Dr. Eisenrath Rogers my recollection of the story of a high school in Santa Maria that was constructed with the windows incorrectly placed, and how the windows all had to come out of the high school after it had been constructed. And I believe there was mold in the building, all kinds of terrible things. Mm-hmm. And so I'm glad to hear that we have some warranties. And it seems like we've got the oversight to make sure the construction is quality.
Yeah, so definitely a good team in place.
On that note, Mr. Unger, would you like to make a motion?
I move approval of Resolution 15-18-19, Measure D.
All right. We have a motion by Mr. Unger, a second by Dr. Eisenrath Rogers. This is a resolution. We'll need a roll call vote, please.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Dr. Eisenrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Mrs. Frame?
Yes.
Resolution passes 5-6 with one absent.
Thank you. All right, we'll move on to our discussion action agenda items. And first up, we have an overview of the California Voting Rights Act. I believe we have a guest speaker this evening in this regard, Mr. Mike Smith of the law firm Lozano Smith, who represents the board in things like this. So thank you for coming and keeping us out of making sure we tread lightly where we need to and keeping us out of hot water.
You're welcome. Sorry. Good evening, everybody. So we're going to talk a little bit about the Voting Rights Act. Then the next item on your agenda will be the potential adoption of a resolution to change the manner in which you vote.
Thank you.
So we'll just start the discussion with substance, and then we're going to end it with process. So let's talk for a second about what's behind the California Voting Rights Act, and the bullet you see there, prevent racially polarized voting. If you were to summarize this law in one phrase, that would be the phrase that you would use. So there are three types of election systems for California school districts, and this is set out in the Education Code. The model that's here, the graphic, the outside blue boundary is intended to be depicting the outside of the district boundary. So you'll notice here that we, for example, in this, there's seven trustees, and then you have, that's the red dot. The blue dot are your registered voters. Trustees can live anywhere, and all voters, no matter where they're residing, can elect all trustees. That is a pure, at-large, classic voting model. A hybrid model. Notice, again, district boundaries are our rectangle, only this time we have internal lines within the district boundaries. So those are your trustee areas. So in this little graphic, we have four trustees, and you'll see that there are the same number of voters in each of the trustee areas. So it's population balanced. So this is the hybrid model, where you have trustee areas, but all of the voters get to elect the trustees. This is your model, a hybrid model. It is a form of at-large voting. By trustee area elections, or district-based trustees. So notice here, again, we have the outside rectangle that's reflecting the district boundaries, only we color-coded, because now we have boundaries, trustee areas, but in this particular election system, only the voters in trustee area one can vote for that trustee. So this is district-based elections. The resolution, if you were to adopt it, would move you from an at-large voting system to that voting system, where it would be a change to simply be district-based elections. So your current system right now, you have the two trustee areas, sort of the coast, the non-coast, with your seven trustees as listed. So what's the legal vulnerability? Why is it we're talking about this? So California, of course, we have to do things uniquely, right? For most states, we have the Federal Voting Rights Act, which was enacted back in 1965, right? Think the Great Society era, LBJ, right? African-American voters being discriminated against. So we have the Federal Voting Rights Act. In California, we decided that wasn't good enough. So in order to prevent discrimination in voting against minorities, we adopted a law in 2003. That law got challenged by the city of Modesto. That case worked its way up to the California, no, to the Fifth District Court of Appeal. And in that court case, the court decided this law was constitutional. And the city of Modesto spent $3 million is what they had to pay out to the plaintiffs, not counting what they paid their own attorney's fees. So I understand that they paid several million themselves. So about $6 million went into the question of, is the California law constitutional? After the city of Modesto case, public agencies throughout California, because remember this law applies not just to school districts, community service districts, cities, counties, all sorts of local public agencies. There has not been one successful lawsuit defending. In other words, when a plaintiff comes at you and says, I believe your system is discriminatory because you're still using a form of at-large voting, every occasion, there has been a settlement with the payment of attorney's fees or in some amount, whether hundreds of thousands of dollars, literally into cities like Santa Paula at $3.2 million and so forth. So legal vulnerability, if you have any form of at-large, either the pure at-large or the hybrid, you're legally vulnerable under the California law. So here in San Luis Obispo County, the county office and Cuesta College moved to the safe harbor, if you will, where they have district-based election systems. The city of Paso Robles, as well as Paso Unified, got served with a demand letter about, it's probably been 2 months ago now, and we worked with the school district there. They did their analysis. They have decided to move to district-based elections. Now, they were sued, so there was a named plaintiff, and if a plaintiff sends a demand letter, they attach a copy of a complete lawsuit in which they've already done the demographic analysis, and they say, you have 45 days to make a decision. You're going to pay us $30,000, or you're going to go to court. And if you go to court and lose, now you're looking at the millions. So it's a little bit, feels like a gun to the head, honestly, from a representing public agencies, which is, you know, what we do. But that's where the city and the school district found themselves recently. So demand letter and then change. And they went ahead and adopted a resolution. And by the way, because we'll talk about this in a second, one of the questions is, when will you implement it? And the agreement, I can say all this publicly now because Paso's been through it, but the settlement agreement in the Paso case is for an election system that will go into effect in the 2022-2024 election cycle, and we'll talk more about that in a second. So, California Voting Rights Act, again, the goal here is to prevent racially polarized voting, in effect, discrimination against minority voters when they can't elect the candidates of their choice or influence the outcome of an election. And notice it prohibits at-large voting districts. So what's missing in that sentence? It doesn't say it prohibits bi-trustee voting systems from having a discriminatory impact. So if you move to a district-based election, by definition, even if the ethnicity of those trustees in future elections never changes, you are protected. Well, it forces you into a place of having district-based elections if you want to avoid the lawsuit, irrespective of whether or not there's an actual change downstream. Part of the assumption in the law is it's easier for minority candidates to get elected because I have a smaller geographic area. Right now I'm out campaigning only in my trustee area, smaller number of voters, smaller cost, and that when you draw maps, if possible, you're going to draw a map that puts as many minority candidates in a single trustee area as possible. And this is why you can see that people could call that gerrymandering on the basis of race, right? Because I'm looking specifically at ethnicity, and I'm drawing a map, and what's my primary consideration? Ethnicity. And that is the reason that the law got challenged in the first instance by the city of Modesto. They felt like it was using race in an inappropriate way, but the court disagreed with that analysis. So we wind up with a California law in which you're legally vulnerable with either a pure at-large election system or a hybrid system, but you're immune from liability if you have a district-based election, even if nothing ever changes downstream. So the key concept here, basically, this is all about money, right? So what happens now, again, that you're unlikely to be able to successfully defend, and no one has done it yet. These are high-cost cases because you have demographic experts, and they become battles of the experts. And so what most local public agencies, school districts, cities, counties, when faced with this, have tended to settle. There was a change in the law. We'll walk through the process part of this in a second, because remember the millions of dollars of fees that I was just telling you people were paying out? But now, look, $30,000. So what happened a couple of years ago is there was a legislative deal cut. And the deal that was cut was plaintiff's attorneys, you only get $30,000. In exchange for that, local public agencies, what do you have to do? Be more transparent. So I'm going to walk you through in a second. Lots of public hearings and technicalities, but if you jump through the hoops, now instead of having an exposure of hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, it's capped at $30,000 if you agree to make the change. On the whole, this was a great deal. So what are your options? Implement bi-trustee elections for 2020. And then you would finish that process in 2022, because remember you have staggered elections, three at one time, four at another time, or implement beginning with a 2022 election cycle, completing that with 2024, or just take no action. And remember that we're going to have the federal census, right? The 2020 census will be taken. The law requires that census data be turned over and be completed no later than April 1st of 2021. So the 2020 census data will be available in the spring of 2021. All right, so our recommendation to you and the resolution that you have next is based on the assumption that you want to move for 2022. And of course, what that does is it saves you demographic costs. If you decide you want to just be bulletproof and go for the 2020 election, you'd hire a demographer now, you would create trustee areas, the census data would be released, you'd get it in 2021, after your first election cycle, right? Then you'd have to go back and redo that study, because once you move to district-based elections, every 10 years, as a matter of law, you have to go back and change the boundaries. And the reason you're changing boundaries every 10 years based on the new census data is because of the one-person, one-vote rule. So we want to make sure that everyone's vote has approximately equal value. Because if you had 10,000 voters in one area, 5,000 voters in another, right, the people that have only 5,000, that vote's worth twice the vote of the district that has 10,000. So we need to balance that and have 7,500 people in both trustee areas for one person, one vote, equal weight. And that's why the law requires that every 10 years you'll have to do this update process. So irrespective of which election cycle you take, you're now going to have this 10-year demographic tweak, if you will. All right, that was the substance. Now talk about process. Do it very quickly here. If you act as if, like tonight, if you guys act, it'll be prior to receipt of a demand letter. What's the advantage? You avoid the risk of the $30,000 attorney's fees. If you wait, you wind up paying the $30,000. The other process here is you can do this by simply adopting a resolution, and then you specify your timeline. And then again, the recommendation for doing option two and doing it for 22-24 election cycle is to save demographic costs. You'll save on the attorney's fees either way, but you'll save on the demographic costs because you'll do it one time using 2020 census. All right. This is the transparency part. This is the legislative deal. So in exchange for the cap of the $30,000 in attorney's fees, look what you wind up having to do. Two hearings before you ever get to a map, two hearings on a map, a final hearing when you got it all done. That didn't used to be the law. So you get all of that done, board finishes its process, it'll adopt a final resolution, it will send it over to Jim Brescia, the county superintendent, who is staff to the county committee. San Luis Obispo County, you have an 11-person county committee. It goes to the county committee that has to hold at least one public hearing. They say yay or nay on it. there's an ed code that says now you got to take it to the electorate. In order to avoid that cost or the possibility it gets voted down, what almost every school district does is you go to the state board, you'll talk with your stakeholder groups, unions, SEIU, CSEA, SLCTA, et cetera. You'll get input. They'll sign off on it. Mm-hmm. We'll complete a waiver form, and then you get out of the election requirement. So that's valuable to you because it reduces your cost, and it doesn't get you into a questionable area. What if the electorate voted down your resolution? Now the voters just said you have an at-large election system and made you legally vulnerable. And that has happened in some occasions with cities because they don't have the same waiver process that school districts do with the State Board of Education. So that will generally be granted, and the State Board understands it, and they'll grant it without on a consent calendar basis. It'll be very easy to obtain. So let's go here because that's really where the recommendation is. So you would adopt the resolution tonight, and then you just kick back, and we don't have to do anything. We wait till the census data comes out. It's now 2021. We have lots of time because we don't have the gun to our head. We don't have the demand letter. There's no plaintiff we have to negotiate with. So you've got lots of time to conduct all those hearings. We get that final resolution. You take it to the county committee. You get your waiver. You send it over to the clerk's office with the elections department. They would implement it. You'll have your first set of trustees elected. So do you see in 2022, some of your trustees will still have been in the hybrid model, and the trustees are up for election in 2022 will have been elected with district-based elections. You with me? And then in 2024, the other set of trustees will be district-based elections, and then it's a fully implemented system. So you'll retain your staggered elections, and you're done then in 2024. Boundaries aren't changing. Board member terms are not changing. All incumbents, your constitutionally elected officers, you have an absolute right to complete your terms. So none of that gets impacted, and then you'll do the adjustment every 10 years.
All right.
Any thoughts or questions?
Yeah. First, I'd like to go to the public, see if anyone has any questions or comments. I have a quick question, and that is, does the demographer create the map? Who makes the map?
The demographer will typically come with like three alternative maps. So, for example, you all have some unique challenges because you have some trustees that live very close to one another. And so the demographer will wind up giving you alternative maps. Each one of them will have to be legally valid. So they'll have to follow natural boundaries. They'll have to be population balanced. In fact, at those first public hearings that you'll do, you're going to develop what's called line drawing criteria. By what standards are we going to create these trustee areas? Then you're going to send the demographer to work. One of the concerns that I've heard from many school districts that have an at-large system, but then they move to a trustee area system, is they get worried about, I'll call it provincial thinking. So you're in a trustee area that only has San Luis Obispo High School. So you start advocating for Slo High. What do I care about Morro Bay High, right? It's not my area. Provincial thinking, right? So one of the things that I love to see a school board talk about is that when you move to trustee areas, you make a commitment to one another that you're not going to do that kind of thinking because that's not a good way to approach things. So you could, for example, say to one of your line drawing criteria is, as many trustee areas as possible, I want to have a segment of Morro Bay High and a segment of Slo High in the same trustee area. So that those trustees have an incentive. You've got some voters in both areas. Now all trustees have an incentive to advocate for both schools. So that would be an example of the line drawing criteria. But ultimately, this is a board call. And I have been at board meetings where the map, because this is all going to be projected on a screen, and the demographer is going to be standing here with a computer, and you're going to say, but what if you move the map to follow 101 here, and we added that area? He'll pull it up and make the change. Right then and right there, and then you'll say, I think I like that boundary better. So it's ultimately board control, but within legally defined parameters.
Okay. Any other questions from the board?
Well, I think it's interesting what you mentioned about the provincialism, because that was one of the things that I recall when Los Angeles Unified went to district trustee elections. Was not only was there sort of a provincialism in terms of who you were representing, but the stakeholders, including principals, now would start going to school board members advocating for their particular school instead of looking at the needs of the district and going to the proper sources in the administration. And that would also be something I think that we would need to talk about and make sure that that was prevented.
Yes, you've got a cultural mindset issue that I think is important to try to maintain the needs of all students at all times, just like the culture of care recommendations that you heard, and so you don't get tied up into area thinking.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, our next item is adoption of a resolution to change from at-large voting to by trustee area voting, and it's my understanding that Mr. Smith has described the resolution to us as in the using the method as he set forth and the timetable. Are there any other questions for him or anyone else on that before we consider adopting that resolution?
And you can see in the whereas clause at the bottom where it says the 2020 census is going to be released after the 2020 election, and then the one if you can move it up a little bit. So this is sort of your whereas clauses keep moving up. So it implements 2022-2024 election cycle.
And then if we adopt this and then receive a letter or a lawsuit, then you work your magic. You show them that this is in place and it should prevent additional exposure.
The only technical exposure you would have if you adopt the resolution now, but you say 2022-2024, is a plaintiff who would say, yeah, that's not as good, I really appreciate that, but not good enough, because you're still discriminating against me in the 2020 election. So that is a theoretical possibility. However, if that happened, then we'd wind up negotiating that $30,000 number.
And have you seen that occur in district?
We actually were able to work with the plaintiff's counsel for Paso Unified, and they in a heartbeat said, we get it. We know school districts are financially strapped.
Great.
We're not. We understand when the census data will be received, and they easily went to the 2022 election cycle. So some theoretical risk here, but minimal.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking
the
time
to
fill
us
in.
All.
Thanks. All right. Our next agenda item is adoption of a resolution to change from at-large voting to by trustee area voting. And I would ask if anyone from the public would like to speak with us before we vote on that. Any further discussion by the board? Then let's make a motion, somebody.
I move approval of resolution 16-18-19 to change from at-large voting to by trustee voting for the election of board members.
Okay, we have a motion by Mr. Unger, a second by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers. Mrs. Campbell.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Dr. Eisendrath Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Mrs. Frame?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Resolution passes 6-0 with one absence.
All right. Thank you. Next is item 9.03, Bright Bites Technology and Learning Survey Highlights.
On.
You brought your own clicker.
I did, because that clicker is too high tech for me.
Oh.
I just can't figure that clicker out. And I'm actually using paper this time, so I'm going old school. There we go. Okay. It's been a long time. So tonight I'm here to present the 2018-19 school year technology and learning survey results as we administered it through Bright Bites. Okay, so before we jump in, I wanted to share our overall vision around technology in the classroom. So on the left of the screen, we see that students are working independently with a device, and that was where we started several years ago, providing devices and Wi-Fi access to our students in the classroom. We have consistently shared the message that our overall goal, as defined by the SAMR model, is to use technology to transform and redefine our teaching and learning. So the graphic on the right of the screen shows more of a collaborative environment where technology is a tool being used to allow us to do new things that would not have otherwise been possible. So just looking at the quote below, it's not the technology, but what we do with it that augments teaching and learning. So these Bright Bites results provide us with evidence of our progress in this journey to a 21st century classroom where technology has been used to redefine teaching and learning. All right, so let's take a look. This year we heard from 287 teachers and administrators, grades K through 12. We heard from 4,753 students, grades 3 through 12. And we heard from 2,462 parents, grades K through 12. So just to give you an idea, the survey takes approximately 15 to 20 minutes and is administered online from any device. Teachers and administrators participated during TCT or staff meetings. Students in grades 3 through 12 participated during class. And then parents were sent out electronic links in school newsletters. And for those that did not have access to devices, we had devices available in school offices, during ELAC meetings, outside of classrooms, and during elementary parent-teacher conferences. So we really communicated to parents strongly that we needed their input, and as you can see, this was the largest group of parents we've heard from in the last 3 years when we've been giving this survey. Also, just to note that the survey is available in both English and Spanish. All right, so just to recap, Bright Bites uses what's called a case framework, and it covers four domains: classroom, access, skills, and environment. And then we developed district-level goals around these domains. And the three that I will touch on tonight are digital citizenship, the use of the four C's, which is communication, collaboration, creativity, and critical thinking, and then home access, specifically home access of our students to devices and Wi-Fi. Okay, so this is the dashboard of our overall score from last year, so that you can see it's 2017-18 results. And looking at the color coding on the bottom and the legend here, let me see, whoops, I pushed the wrong button. Juana, this is too high-tech for me. Okay, let's get to, there we go. Oh, this is the button. There we go. So this is the legend down here at the bottom, and these are color-coded so that kind of helps us understand what we're looking at the top. The classroom was an area that we really emphasized this year because last year we were still emerging in that area, as well as access to technology at home. That was a big push. So this year, let's see, I did jinx myself. That's not it. There we go. Okay, wrong button. Okay, so this year, now this is the 2018-19 results, and we see that we do see overall growth, and more importantly, the two domains that we targeted, which was classroom and access, have both improved. So our classroom domain has moved from emerging to proficient, so it's gone from the pink to the orange, and our access has moved from advanced, which was great last year, to exemplary, which is the blue. Okay. And just to kind of help us look at our progress overall, we've done this survey 3 times now, and you can see the dots on the bottom here. This was our first data collection back in 2017, and then we did another one towards the end of the year, and then this is this year's. So we've had 3 different data collections, and you can see that we're improving overall. Okay. All right, so now let's dive in a little deeper into each goal. And the first goal is to increase learning of student digital citizenship. Okay. All right, so there's a lot of information on this graphic. This illustrates the overall trends that we see in our digital citizenship skills, and it's been broken apart by teachers and by students. Teachers are the upside-down triangle, so they're on the top, the little top here. And students are, let's see, yes, and then the students are the right-side-up triangle, so they're the pink on the bottom. Okay, and again, you see the three data collection cycles here. So this was a couple of years ago, and then our second data collection, and this is our most recent. Okay, so BrightBytes measures all of this by looking at the frequency that students are taught digital citizenship skills, such as bullying, citing information, posting information, having an online presence, etc. And then teachers are measured by both the frequency that they teach digital citizenship skills as well as their knowledge and comfort level of teaching these skills. Okay, so this graph shows an upward trend in both teachers and students, as you can see. And so we can attribute some of this to what we did this year. We had ongoing PD, especially around digital citizenship in the classroom. We had parent outreach nights at the middle schools. We provided monthly family tip sheets, things to do at home with your child to promote digital citizenship and responsible use. We also asked elementary libraries to focus on digital citizenship. And the library techs did a great job of doing that this year. So if you visit some of our sites, you will see evidence of that in the libraries, in the elementary libraries especially. And then EdTech leads. We focused on that quite a bit, and we had a meeting in the fall where we really emphasized what we're going to do as far as digital citizenship in the classroom. And so this next slide.
Jennifer?
Oh, yes, go ahead. Uh-huh. Sure.
Can you tell me again the student line, what was measured?
Pardon me?
What was measured?
Oh, sorry, what was measured?
What was measured in the student?
So the students are measured on how often they are taught digital citizenship skills. So bullying is one of the topics, citing information, citing their sources and things online, posting information, having an online presence, those kinds of things. Okay. All right. And so this slide is the result of a meeting, and these are just a brainstorming session that we had in the fall with EdTech leads. We looked at our BrightBytes data by site because it is we can look at it by site, and then went through some activities. We set goals, and we generated these ideas around how to incorporate digital citizenship into our classrooms. So as I read through some of these ideas, what jumped out at me the most was the need to incorporate and integrate the digital citizenship throughout the curriculum, and that it can't be done with just one lesson or two lessons here and there in a separate curriculum. We also need to continue to nurture and develop a collaborative environment where we are educating not only our students, but our staff and our parents on these important skills. All right, so let's look at goal two, increasing the use of the four C's. And the four C's, as you can see, are communication, collaboration, creativity, and critical thinking. Okay. All right, so this graphic shows trends around the four C's. The diamonds represent the students, so that's the top line there, the yellow line. And the squares represent the teachers. Okay, so these are the students. And these are the teachers. Okay. And we can see that students are already proficient and they are improving. Okay. Teachers have shown a slight improvement and they may be doing more than they realize. Okay, and I'll show you that in just a moment. Because this is a survey based on teacher and student beliefs around technology. Okay. So the following slides will dive in a little bit deeper and look at a few specific data points around the teacher use of the four C's. Okay. All right. This graphic is an example of a data point around critical thinking, as highlighted at the top. Okay. This chart shows us that the frequency at which teachers ask students to identify and solve authentic problems using technology. Okay. Looking at the boxes at the top, this is how they measured it as far as frequency goes, from at least weekly to monthly. And monthly, those are the two areas that we want to see improve, and then every few months all the way down to never. Okay? So basically, in simple terms, the goal is for the yellow and the pink to decrease and the green and the blue to increase. So that'll be easier illustrated when I remove the yellow and the pink. Okay. So now we see that the frequency on the green, the monthly, and at least weekly is going up. And that's what we want to see. Okay. Another item I want to point out that Bright Bites offers us when we're looking at this data is this why this matters. And Bright Bites provides us these citations of the relevance of what we are measuring and the impact it can have on the future of our students. So they offer these little nuggets, which are helpful. Okay. And this is a data highlight around creativity, another one of the four C's, as noted in the highlight at the top right here. So this is a creativity data point. Notice that the difference in what teachers say on the left versus what students say on the right. 32% of teachers say that they regularly ask students to create multimedia presentations, okay? While 56% of students say that their teachers ask them to do this on a regular basis. Okay, so there's a difference here. And we talked about this, the EdTech leads and I, and we've talked about this because we see this in other areas as well. And the difference could be due to student and teacher perceptions because, like I said, this is a survey based on beliefs. Okay, so we surveyed all classroom teachers, K-12, all of them, including auto shop teachers, PE teachers, everyone. Therefore, a kindergarten teacher or a secondary auto shop teacher may not be asking students to create a multimedia presentation. Okay, so those students are getting asked to do multimedia presentations, but maybe not by those teachers. So that may account for the difference in the percentage. Okay. So therefore, it's really important to look closely at this data and pay attention to what our students are saying, who's responding to the survey, what our teachers are saying, so that we can make informed decisions around PD needs and our next steps. Okay. All right. Let's look at goal 3, student access to devices and Wi-Fi at home. All right, so this graph shows the upward trend of both teachers and students on their access to technology at home and at school. Remember, the green indicates advanced and the blue indicates exemplary. So our teachers and students at home are exemplary when measuring home access. So you can see these triangles here represent teachers at home. These green triangles, students. This is where we saw the improvement here from last year to this year, so we went from advanced to exemplary. And one factor we can attribute to the success of our student home, the access for our students at home, is the T-Mobile grant, which you're familiar with. And it allows students access to MiFi devices and Chromebooks for checkout from their sites. And it obviously gives our school district a 70% discounted rate for those devices. So we applied this, and we saw an improvement here. Okay. All right. And then finally, access to homework. This was a customized question, and we asked it again this year. We asked it last year and again this year to parents. Is your child able to complete homework if online access is required? And 95% of parents reported yes. My child is able to complete homework if online access is required. So again, this is exactly the same percentage as last year.
And was that simply a yes or no question?
Yes, it was a customized question that we asked them to put in the survey. So it's not part of the overall results. It's a right. Separate question.
Mm-hmm. So the 5% who answered no. Mm-hmm. We don't have any additional information as to who they are,
no.
why they said no, or what
no.
we need to do.
We don't, because, and I didn't say this earlier, but the survey is anonymous. So this was only asked to parents. So we don't know which parents said that
So if we do this again, mm-hmm. would we be able to ask for a little bit of additional information? If not, you know, get in touch with us, or
we certainly could. There's other data points in here that I couldn't put everything in here.
Sure.
It's a giant, you know, data source here, and there are other indicators that are that are showing us that students are getting more access and able to do complete homework and have more access to the devices and Wi-Fi at home. This was just a customized question, so we're really limited on what we can get from it. But we can certainly, pose that to our sites and see if we need to get more information on that 5%.
And are our teachers aware that they may have a student in their classroom or more than one student in their classroom who may not have availability at home?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we've really emphasized that and made it clear. We don't want teachers assigning things to students when they don't have access at home and they can't complete their homework. But every single site has access to the MiFi devices and Chromebook cart checkouts.
Sure, which is great. Mm-hmm. If the student says he or she needs it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. Yes.
So Jennifer, just some questions to follow up on this. I thought it was my understanding that we were going to ask specifically what type of device they thought they had access to, because folks may think that they have access and it's their phone, mm-hmm. and that's not really usable for homework.
Yes, we do have that available. We do have that data available.
Okay.
So they did. It's not in this presentation, but we do have that available so I can certainly get that to you.
And then we did not ask this of students at all?
Well, no, we did not ask this customized question to students. We just asked it to parents. So it's beliefs, too. So we're looking at beliefs. That's a question: is your child able to complete homework if online access is required? We don't know what they're assuming online access is,
right,
or homework,
exactly.
or anything. So it's just to give us an idea, I think, of what's out there and what mm-hmm. we need to do as far as next steps. And just, like I said, these are beliefs. It's an anonymous survey. We may not have heard from all parents, on this particular question. So they could have skipped this question and continued to answer.
Sure.
So we just don't know.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate all the constraints that you're under, and it's really quite impressive. Earlier we saw that the perception of students to, mm-hmm. to their teachers was quite different.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. I'm hoping that sometime in the future we can see what the students' perception is compared to their parents, because I think that would mm-hmm. be, for me, that would be valuable data.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if we
yes.
have agreement or how we do that.
Okay.
So, thanks.
Yes.
Yeah, I would follow up on that as well, and in light of Mr. Buckman's question, to say that, mm-hmm. that I think that would be an equally valid question to mm-hmm. ask of the student. If
mm-hmm.
if the student, are you able to complete homework
mm-hmm.
if online access is required?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, it would be an interesting question, and it may be actually more valuable to ask the students, because there were clearly 50% more, or actually double the number of students just about who answered the survey as opposed to parents that answered the
mm-hmm.
survey. So 4,000
mm-hmm.
and change,
mm-hmm.
in the equivalent of what, about 2,700 parents or something.
Yes.
Yeah. So even here though, we're looking at 135 parents or so who are saying that they don't believe their kids have
right.
access to it, and that's pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
And not even knowing where those might be concentrated,
mm-hmm.
or who we're talking about. I don't
yes.
know if there's any way of teasing that out as people are talking about, but it would be valuable if we could learn any
mm-hmm.
of that so we can help target the families
Absolutely.
That are most in need.
Uh-huh.
So,
Yeah, we didn't adjust this question. We kept it the same so we could see if there was going to be any change or growth from last year to this year. So perhaps it's time to look at getting some more information.
Thank you.
In a different way.
Mr. Mm-hmm. Buckman.
I'm sorry. I'll wait till the presentation's over.
Okay. And then our conclusions, again, our focus areas. We want to expand the use of the four C's across classroom and content areas. Okay. And maybe close that gap between what students are believing and what teachers are believing. Continue focusing on digital citizenship skills across content areas. And then continue to monitor and close the gap of the home access piece, definitely. Some actions, we're starting a spring data review with directors and principals, so principals meetings, ed tech lead meetings. We're starting to look again at our data, at their data, because it is, you know, aggregated by site. Again, and then we'll have those conversations and make some adjustments and things with ed tech leads and other groups, district groups, next year. PD around digital citizenship and the four C's, definitely more of that. Continue the parent tips and outreach on digital citizenship. We've had success with that. We want to definitely continue that. And then, of course, continue the T-Mobile program. So, all right, any questions?
Is there funding still available for the set T-Mobile program?
Yes.
Remain funded for a while?
Yes, and I took notes because Jeremy's not here, but yes, we signed up for a 24-month agreement, and that excludes summer months. So we're still in, I think we still have another, it means it's more of a 2.5-year program, mm-hmm. So we still have another year or year and a half left on that.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yes.
Mr. Buckman and then mm-hmm. Mr. Unger.
Thanks. So, Jennifer, we uh-huh. talk about we have the Wi-Fi devices, we mm-hmm. have the Chromebooks.
Mm-hmm.
How are students identified as those that need those devices?
Yes. So students are identified by the parents' responses on to questions on InfoSnap when they are registering their students.
So it's digital access that determines digital access?
Well, parents have to register their children in school, so they are identified by a questionnaire and InfoSnap, and I'm not sure if I can, if perhaps Kim can answer that. Yeah.
I can help a little. So the online registration process is either online or paper.
Okay.
So obviously every child has to register for school.
Right.
So there's the same questions, whether it's digital or in paper. And then also, I know the schools also, teachers identify students, counselors identify students, administrators identify students. When they see that someone is needing something, they'll look for confidential ways to offer help and to get them devices when they see a need.
Okay. I had a crazy idea that I'll discuss later with you guys, but I had some other questions. Is it mm-hmm. possible to, as we have mm-hmm. the T-Mobile, is it possible to specifically set aside LCAP money and Title I money? Because I don't remember that being at least in the Title I report last year, so that we can also use that mm-hmm. to ensure.
We do currently use LCAP funds to purchase devices.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And would this come under Title I? Is that possible to use Title I funds?
I think it's probably best for LCAP funding.
Great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Hang on just a second.
Can we go to Mr. Unger while you find your other questions?
Sure, while I fumble through. Sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, all right. Well, then yours. Oh, all right.
Yes.
I don't know if this is a concern, but I tried to learn from you guys. So when we measure, we're measuring measurable data or data that seems to actually give us. Let me try that this way. Mm-hmm. So that what I hear is a lot of measurement of numbers: how many people, mm-hmm. how many devices, how many students,
mm-hmm.
Times that they've been assigned a project.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm wondering is missing, and maybe it's in the other data, is how did students do on those projects? Did they show improvement on the actual projects? Because while I appreciate the number of times they've been assigned, I'm trying to learn from you guys, mm-hmm. it seems like, did they improve?
Mm-hmm. That's not going to be reflected in this data, that kind of information on student achievement on the digital projects.
Okay.
Unfortunately. So.
Thanks.
Mrs.
I appreciate
Roger.
It.
Thank you. I'm wondering, this is maybe a more a Jeremy question, but I'm very concerned about the 5%.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if the T-Mobile grant is renewable.
Yes, he said, I believe he said it was, but I want to confirm that with him. Let me see if I had written notes.
From what I remember, Ms. Roger, we can, and we have to use this data to show the number that are needed. And so that's part of why we really encourage participation there, is because there can be a direct correlation to what we qualify for in the number of devices that they're willing to grant us.
But what we're seeing in this data would definitely demonstrate need.
Mm-hmm. 5% need. So, right, that we would be able to ask for that percentage, that number of devices.
If you extrapolate it out,
okay.
It's much higher.
Mr. Bachman?
Thank you.
Yes, thanks. So it occurs to me again, so when we've made available technology for people to use that, have we tracked the number of people that have actually done it? I'm not asking for names or ethnicities, but how many responses we got by making the devices available at schools and at DLAC and
I'm not sure that they're tracking, that they're actually tracking it. I mean, I'm sure there's a checkout process, so we can certainly find out if something gets lost or we need to replace it. Yeah. We're absolutely keeping track of that.
Okay.
But I'm not keeping track of demographic use of what's being checked out.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's okay.
I'm sorry. I'm specifically trying to take out the demographic and just say X number of people stood at the kiosk at Pacheco and entered their data, because then we know that they probably don't have access at home. And
the survey?
Yeah.
Oh,
is that an effective? Has that been effective in getting more?
Well,
more surveys completed.
I've noticed this is the highest number of parents we've heard from. So, and when we compare ourselves, we're able to compare ourselves to county data and state data. So I think we're reaching a lot of our parents more than other local, other surrounding areas when we're targeting parents. So whatever we're doing, we're increasing the amount of parent responses.
Maybe they're using.
We don't have 100%, but we are improving.
Yeah, so maybe those T-Mobile devices are working.
Maybe they are, yes.
So that may ask her part of this. So my concern is that this is actually a fairly small percent of the parents. And yet we're pinning a lot of our comments, like 95% of the parents have access. When in, I did the math, but I'm not going to do it because I'm sure my math is wrong. And then I was a little concerned. I think, the students are like, yay, 61%, wow. But I was a little concerned about the low number of staff, of teachers that filled this out. Is that a concern?
Well, we always want, 100%. We heard from, 287 teachers? Yes.
30%.
Yeah, but they do require a statistically significant number in order for Bright Bytes to calculate the data. So we have, in order for it to be measurable, so we met our statistical significant thresholds on at all schools for both staff and students.
Okay. Last question.
Yes.
So on the little notes, which were really good to have, one of the people said something about monitoring the copyright. And then one of them said, and I have to make sure I do that. So I'm wondering, students sign a technology use agreement which specifically says copyrights and teaches about it. Does staff sign a technology use agreement? How's that translated?
It's a responsible use agreement. All right, is that right, Kim, that we sign? Yes.
Okay.
They've changed the verbiage a little bit. Okay. So now it's responsible use agreement. Okay. And that's what I said. It's important, I think, that it's not just our students that we're trying to educate, but it's our staff and our parents, too, because there's so much out there and there's so much changing. So it really takes a village for all of this to work.
Well, I really appreciate all this work. Thank you.
Ms. Frain, then Mr. Unger.
Sorry.
Do you have a question?
No. Jen,
yes.
Regarding the parent tips, outreach on digital citizenship, is it are we looking at it differently for different groups of parents? And I'm thinking specifically, mm-hmm. you know, having those devices, you know, parents bring them to the ELAC meetings, mm-hmm. and so that they're practicing, you know, with their children, mm-hmm. and so there's that. It looks differently at, you know, for different parent
mm-hmm.
groups.
Yeah.
And so it'd be just an idea to kind of differentiate that.
We do a little. We have it broken down by elementary, middle school, and high school. So mm-hmm. based on, you know, what's appropriate, you know, for elementary versus mm-hmm. high school, those tips and things might be a little bit different. And they are pushed out in Spanish as well.
No, but I mean, I was thinking of actually at the meeting having the parents practice it.
Yes. You know, at like DLAC or ELAC.
Yeah,
or,
yeah. Uh-huh. Just so that mm-hmm. they develop that.
Absolutely, yes.
Thank mm-hmm. you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Unger?
Mark, I need to gently disagree with you. I think 2,300 parental responses is out of, you know, the universe of responses when mm-hmm. we think about that. That's a pretty good response rate. Mm-hmm. I'd certainly like more, of course, but, mm-hmm. you know, that's, mm-hmm. what, about 30 or so percent, mm-hmm. I'm guessing, of, and I'm not a mathematician, of the 7,500 students mm-hmm. who are in our district. And 7,500 students would be, there would be fewer parents than that because, you know, we have two or three mm-hmm. child families.
Right.
I was happy actually to see the number of parental responses mm-hmm. we've gotten, and mm-hmm. I hope we can continue to increase mm-hmm. it. The only other thing, Kim, and I would just mention, and I don't know if it'll make any difference, is I believe that T-Mobile and Sprint are merging, and I was kind of actually surprised to see the T-Mobile store in Los Osos had an AT&T sign out in front of it now. So I'm just hopeful that. That merger won't affect our ability to provide the services for our students, and just something we should be looking at mm-hmm. as we renew our contract.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Buckland.
So, Chris, mm-hmm. I appreciate it, and I think dialogue's good.
Yeah.
So I think one-third, and then I'm not sure how to do the math, and of the one-third, 95%, so 5%, and how do we extrapolate mm-hmm. the number beyond that? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that I find interesting is our SED number is normally floats, and our achievement gap and a lot of numbers that we look at normally floats between 30% and 40%. Mm-hmm. And so my concern is that if we've seen, and there's mm-hmm. no way to track this, which is mm-hmm. great, but my gut is we're looking at just a similar sort of achievement gap. And so that's maybe more my concern than the number, and mm-hmm. And I think that's something that we might get a good handle on mm-hmm. if you're able to pursue at least some kind of hard number on the number of people that are taking advantage of your increased access, because I remember originally it was just mm-hmm. in the lobby.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm truly am hoping for tremendous more access, but you know, the numbers are interesting.
Yes, definitely. And I mean, there's still a gap, and we're not going to ignore that. We're going to continue to work to continue to close that. So,
anything else? Thank you. Thanks very much. Mm-hmm. All right. Next is item 9.04, the LCAP outreach plan for 2018-19.
Thank you. Happy to give you an update on our LCAP outreach plan. I think this is the fourth update, if I remember right, that we've done this year. So we've made some great progress on gathering input from a variety of stakeholders related to our outreach. And I think the best one to look at this time, Ms. Campbell, would be this graphic. We have shown the rubric in the past, and we have shown the kind of timeline I know you've looked at before, so I thought I might focus on this graphic this time. So we are kind of traveling around the clock on this graphic as far as the types of outreach that we've completed, and I just wanted to summarize some of those for you. So you've heard a few times about the Superintendent Student Senate, and we have great input from the students that have now started to give presentations to the teachers at their sites and started to summarize the elements credits that would be sometimes held within the LCAP, but sometimes those are also site goals, so you might see those in different, accounted for in different places. The Common Ground Task Force that obviously you heard from the two representatives earlier today, so we will take those recommendations and look at which ones make sense for the LCAP or which ones make sense in a different location. You have to keep in mind that, remember that the LCAP funds is that about $7 million is about what we spend right now on LCAP, and we're required to spend about 4.7. And keep in mind that those funds are specifically for three groups of students, right? So socioeconomically disadvantaged, EL, foster homeless youth. So sometimes I think people misinterpret LCAP funds to think about what we're doing as a district as a whole. And instead, that's closer to a $95-ish million budget. And we're thinking about this pocket of money that we know these students are going to have additional obstacles, and what can we do with those funds to ensure that we're doing things above and beyond for those students. Okay, so kind of keep that in mind. Say that again.
How much did you say we're obligated to spend?
Obligated 4.7.
Thank you.
So staff presentations. I know we've mentioned that in the past. Mr. Pinkerton and I have concluded those staff presentations. We've made it around to every site, including district office, et cetera. Giving our presentation, Mr. Pinkerton starts with kind of an overall budget update. A lot of people have questions about Diablo and the impact of that closure. We also give a foundation update so that everyone kind of understands, and then we dive into LCAP, and we, again, explain kind of the purpose of the funds, talk about here's how we've spent it in the past. We give the link so that if you're, you know, a detailed person, you may go look at every single dollar of how that is spent, and then this, keep in mind that this is our third year. We're walking into the third year of a three-year plan. So we will not likely make sweeping changes, but there will be some changes. We've put out the staff survey and gathered that information. And Rick Mayfield held the last LCAP Advisory Committee meeting where we looked at every word of those survey results. I will tell you a couple things that stood out to me personally from the survey results is, Mr. Bingerton mentioned earlier class sizes, even though that doesn't really have anything to do with an LCAP funding. I think people are always just feel compelled to mention it. However, the two pieces that likely would impact LCAP is we heard from people about their desire for more interventions for students that continue to struggle even after our strong first best instruction. We also heard the need for ELD. English language designated, especially English language development, which did come from our FPM finding as well. So that is something that we kind of heard from that direction, and we're hearing from staff that they see a need to continuing to modernize and develop that program further. So I know that will be upcoming work that we will continue to do. Of course, there's other feedback, right, from the survey. I'm just picking out two big pieces that rang true to me. So the LCAP Advisory Committee, I just mentioned that meeting, they looked at Bright Bites data last time as well as looking at the LCAP survey feedback. I divided into groups so that by the end every single word had been read and every comment analyzed, really looking for patterns, and then shared out with a group. So I believe Mr. Mayfield's going to be bringing that to Cabinet next week as well for us to begin to analyze. Board meeting presentations, obviously, you are aware of. We talked about our equity team and our LCAP advisory also. So that is the update at this point. We are starting to get to adding that information and starting to really make a difference on adjusting the things within our third year of our LCAP, and you will, at the next one, see an overview. You remember the long, colorful document that had the focus areas at the top, kind of summarize the input, and then kind of the major action. So that will be the next update that I will bring to you.
Hi.
Any questions?
Is there anyone from the public here to address us on this? Mr. Buckman.
Thanks. Just an amazing amount of growth in our outreach. It's just, it's so cool. So I had just two quick questions, and I don't necessarily need an answer on this first one. I would be interested to know what the makeup is of the LCAP Advisory Committee. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you're allowed to, but sort of mm-hmm. SED, community, businesses, I don't know, because I have not had the opportunity to attend. Mm-hmm. However, last year, we noted on the calendar that DTAC was the only group that was meeting early in the morning and actually the only group that was meeting during the day. And as I remember, I know there was at least one meeting that I was able to attend with Rick that was in the evening. So, Rick, maybe you can, so did we see a better attendance in the evening or daytime? Or, but it just it keeps jumping out at me that it, mm-hmm. that it's the only one that's during the day.
Mm-hmm. You're here.
Yeah, I wouldn't say necessarily we were aiming for a better turnout to do it in the morning. The DTAC is made up of site representatives from each site. So we did it so that people could make presentations and we had a meeting out on the coast. But I'm not sure that the goal of having that meeting at that hour was to...
Right. I'm sorry. I wasn't clear. Last year on the calendar, it showed it as a 9:30 meeting. I think it was adjusted to be like a 6:30 meeting. It was at San Luis High. So I'm just kind of it was in your office. I was interested to know if there was better attendance in the evening than you had attendance this year in the morning. I'm not advocating for morning.
Yeah.
In fact, if I was going to advocate, I'd advocate for evening, but
right.
You've got the data now. So
I'd say it was about the same.
There you go.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bet.
Anything else? All right.
I just had one question.
Oh, sorry.
Hi. The 4.7 is the amount of funding that we receive for LCAP. And
you would explain that.
Yeah, I don't understand. Well, 4.7
would do
and 7
this
million.
Motion. And Ryan would do this motion.
If we were,
and say it's all in
if
one
we
part.
Were an LCFF school district, that was.
That's what we would receive.
That would be the amount of money that we would receive in supplemental funds for those three groups of students.
So we are pulling from the general fund?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to the 4.7, the general fund is
there's other items that are part of our LCAP that, you know, you could say are good for all kids, not necessarily just for the three groups, and so there's a balance with some of that.
But didn't you indicate it's about that we spend about seven
yes.
something million?
The yeah. 4.7 is dedicated for the three groups.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So it's all general fund. The 7 million is all general fund. Oh. Or is there?
No, there's a few other
title
things.
Title one, title
yeah.
two.
A few other things accounted for
well.
There.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any ballpark idea of what the offset is?
Of the amount or the funds
amount.
Where they're from? I don't know.
No.
Off the top of my head, do you know?
No,
I don't know.
I'll have to. Mm-hmm.
No idea.
Yeah.
About $800,000 or something.
Maybe a third of it is offset, perhaps?
Oh, no, no. It's at most of it is general fund.
Okay.
Most of the $7 million is general fund.
Okay. And that's money set aside specifically to address the needs of our poor children, our English language learners, and our foster and homeless
youth. Yes, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else?
Yeah, can I ask a so?
Oh, sorry, Chris.
We, because we're a basic aid school district, do we actually receive the concentrate, not, well, we wouldn't get the concentration funds, but do we receive the actually extra separate targeted funds from the state for our LCAP other than... Well, Title I, of course, is a federal program, and I think it's, what, about $800,000 or something like that
yeah.
that we get in Title I. So do we get additional state money, which would, if we were a non-basic aid school district, which would be LCAP-specific money, or as Mrs. Rogers suggesting, is it all because we're basic aid school district coming out of our general fund, and the $4.7 million is money we would have gotten separately from the state, only we don't get it, but we're targeting it anyway. Do you see what my
question
is?
So that's the second. It would be the second thing. So in that, so we have to actually do our own LCFF calculation as a school district. So if we were basic aid into tomorrow, we were LCFF, Julie Lang does our LCFF. So what we would receive, which we actually put down on the 10-year projection, what we would be if we were LCFF. And then out of that calculation, part of it is what would we would receive if we were supplemental funds based on the number of ELs, economic disadvantaged foster homeless youth. So for us in our school district, out of our $80 million we received, we were LCFF, about $4.7 million of that would be dedicated towards supplemental funds for those groups of students. Now, we receive more than that, but we actually still have to write an LCAP like every other school district that focuses it on that number, at least that number, that's being budgeted specifically for that plan.
But again, except for Title I, we're not receiving state money. So we do the calculation. Mm-hmm. We know that this is the amount of money that we absolutely must spend.
Yes.
But it's coming out of our general fund. It's not from our state. It's not from our state contribution.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Are we good?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Next is Measure D and Morro Bay High School J-Wing Modernization.
So it's this trifecta process in terms of terminating a lease for lease-leaseback agreement. So the board passed the resolution earlier in the meeting. This is the actual termination of the lease-leaseback agreement. In the consent agenda, there is the termination of the quick deed, so taking back the property from the contractor as well. So what we're asking the board tonight is to end this agreement that we have, the lease itself, and terminate that agreement with Acme Construction Company.
Is there anyone from the public wishing to comment on this topic, on this item? All right, hearing none, we'll come back to the board. Any discussion? If not, then a motion. Mrs. Roger.
I will approve the termination agreement and quitclaim deed. Just trying to see if it has a formal title here, between ourselves and Acme Construction for work performed on the J-Wing at Morro Bay High School.
I'll
second. All right, we have a motion by Mrs. Rogers, second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
All right, passes unanimously with the absence of Mr. Millar. All right, next is another Measure D amendment, number 2, to the lease-leaseback contract with Acme Construction for the San Luis High School new gym modernization project.
So this is actually the last lease-leaseback project that we have at San Luis Obispo High School. So as the rest of the projects that we'll be moving forward with are all going to be part of the design-build process, so which is basically half the campus. Mr. Holcomb actually attended the bid opening for this GMP, I believe in Modesto when they opened the bids there, and he was there to make sure, the process and in terms of the acceptance of the bids. And so we actually have met several times to go over this particular bid and what's in it and not, and additions, those types of things. We just had a meeting last week, Mr. Bonin, Steve Stewart, who's the project manager at the site, as well as myself, going through that GMP line by line with Mr. Vestagni, who's kind of the lead contractor in this. We did take out a few items out of the GMP initially, which was redoing the bleachers on the floor at this time. And so this is a pretty big project in terms of the new gym, newer gym, I should say. So it's completely redoing the roof on that facility. It's adding HVAC, so new heating, new air conditioning, huge fan inside, so painting the entire facility, redoing the restrooms. As you walk kind of the mid-hallway there's huge restrooms for both men and women. It's also making the shower areas ADA compliant, so that's a big portion of it. So you'll see as you go through the GMP kind of the big things that stand out with the roof. There's a big charge for asbestos abatement, both in the tile and ceiling, those types of things, that goes along with the demolition. And then there's a huge, again, the HVAC meant that the electrical, that there's a big charge for electrical as well as the plumbing that's going to go on in both the shower areas as well as the bathrooms. So I think we've narrowed it down. Again, this has the skilled and trained workforce requirement is tied to it, right, which kind of limits the number of contractors. that are able to bid on this work. And so in looking at kind of the old gym work that was done at both Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo High School, everything seems to be in line with kind of what we've been paying over the last few years. So it's not great. It's not fantastic for us. But, you know, prices are high right now as we move forward. So it came in a little under $5 million for the entire project. Marilyn.
I'm just confused because the agenda item I'm reading is just simply a transfer of the liability insurance, construction liability insurance.
So that's the one underneath it. That's next.
Oh, okay. No wonder it made no sense to me. Okay, because I understand the one I read. Okay.
Yeah, so we found in the process, which is the next item on the agenda for you, is that it's much cheaper for the district to do the builder's risk insurance ourselves than have the contractor do it. So that's kind of the next item that we'll be asking the board to respond to us.
So we're at 9.06 right now.
So, Mr. Holcomb, anything to add in terms of the bid process for this
six
project?
Which the numbers are different, but they are right there. 9.06 is the liability insurance, and that's where we should be.
Mrs. Schiffer, may I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Can we assume that the defunct solar panels are going away?
Those are going away. The solar panels that were never used, yes.
Yes, that will be an improvement.
And this is a facility, too, that I must say, it when it rains, it leaks. So they have basketball games or things like that. There's literally water coming, you know, that they have buckets on the ground type thing. So, you know, it's kind of a must-do in terms of moving forward and really saving the envelope of that building.
Is that called a home court advantage?
Yeah, maybe. A little slippery.
Okay. I have not gone to the public yet for this. Is there anyone of our giant public? All right. Then any further discussion on 9.06? All right. Seeing none. We need to adopt this resolution this evening.
I move adoption of this Measure D Amendment Number 2 to LLB contract with ACME Construction for the San Luis Obispo High School new gym modernization project.
Thank you.
I'll second that.
All right. We have a motion by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, a second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All right. Motion carries 6-0. Next.
This is a project that will start at the end of May, just so that you know. We'll run through the summer months, you know, as to try not to conflict. And our hope is to get the facility back, the gym and the wrestling room, around September, I believe, and then get the locker rooms after that. But at least they'll be able to have volleyball and games and things for the fall season to actually be able to use that facility. We'll be using Taylor Gym as a boys and girls locker room, as well as the old gym. So different areas throughout. So we're going to, you know, for both sports teams as well as for PE classes. So we're going to use, again, over the next few years, every space on that campus will be used to make, you know, to get us through these, you know, these times. But definitely for something like this, we wanted to maximize and try to have most of the construction window happen during the summer. So the next item is what I just talked about in terms of, again, with all of our projects, we found that the builder's risk insurance for us is much cheaper if the district does it itself. And so it doesn't, for the construction company, it's just what they have to pay anyway. So for us, what it means is we not only get it at a cheaper rate, but then we don't have to pay the markup on it as well. So it's kind of a win-win in terms of that. So what we're asking the board to do is to approve the next amendment, which basically means that the district will be providing that insurance instead of the contractor. And again, kudos to Kelly Lee for tracking this down.
And to Mr. Holcomb.
Yes.
Yeah. Got our folks are earning their keep here. Mrs. Roger, do you have a question about this?
I am so familiar with this. I just can't even tell you. If there are no questions, I'd like to move approval of what are we calling this baby?
It's amendment number 3.
SLO High School new gym amendment number 3.
All right, we have a motion by Mrs. Rogers, a second by Ms. Brehm. Any further discussion? All in favor? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right, motion carries 6-0. All right, 9.08, proposed revisions to board policy, local control and accountability plan. Mrs. McGrath is going to make sure this is a very suspense-filled topic this evening. Don't keep us waiting. We're on pins and needles.
Okay, apologies. Okay, 0460 is first. Okay, so this board policy has been... originated through our legal counsel. It did go through the subcommittee. So you will notice the red portions at the top adjusted there. Notice that it says specific actions aligned with state and local priorities. Instead, the thought was that didn't make a whole lot of sense, change to the district budget. You can see the inclusion of equity and the numerically significant student subgroups, and you can see the addition there as well. And I believe there was one other portion we wanted to mention. You'll notice also on the final page, the assistance of identification of district strengths and weaknesses according to the state priorities are listed there. I think those are the significant changes to note. This is the first reading.
Right.
I think we were about to say the same thing.
Yes.
And so our typical pattern would be to bring this back for a second reading.
Anyone have any comments on this? All right. Then we will move on to, and no one, just for purposes of clarification, we have no public any longer. So we will dispense with requesting their input. All right. Next, we have another first reading, proposed revisions to the policy regarding personnel reduction.
Yes, so personnel reduction, you can see that a lot of suggestions about removing old language and layoff information. You can see that the new information starts with the governing board's policy there, starting with how they may reduce probationary or permanent, and a lot of additions there that you can see in red. This did as well go through the subcommittee, and we were trying to be thoughtful about timing. This is purposefully placed after March 15th so that no one would mistakenly think that this was related to any layoffs that we were thinking of, because fortunately we have not had to do that. Again, this is first reading, so our practice would be to typically bring this back for a second reading.
Any comments from the board on this? A testament to the subcommittee's work.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay, next is the action consent portion of our program. Please let me know if you would like anything pulled. Item 10.01, approve the quarterly report on uniform complaint filings, aka the Williams settlement. Oh, Marilyn. 10.02, Measure D, approve notice of completion. 10.03, proposed revisions to board policy 1240, volunteer assistance. 10.04, proposed revisions to board policy 1340, access to district records. 10.05, proposed revisions to board policy 4112.2, certification. 10.06, proposed revisions to board policy 4115, evaluation, supervision. 10.07, proposed revisions to board policy 6178, career technical education. 10.08, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 10.09, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 10.10, approval of purchase orders and Cal card purchases. 10.11, approval of warrants and payroll. 10.12, acceptance of donations. 10.13, approval of field study trip requests, SLO High School robotics team to Louisville, Kentucky. I would appreciate a motion on items 10.02 through 10.13.
I move approval of item 10.02 to 10.13.
I'll second. We have a motion by Mr. Unger, second by me. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Mrs. Roger.
Thank you. I pulled this item, which I'll get back to. It is item 10.01 having to do with the William.
There you go. Having to do with the Williams settlement complaint form. Quarterly, we're required to submit results of to make clear to the public any complaints that we may have received with regard to having sufficient textbooks to our facilities. Any facility deficiencies and having appropriate staff available. And we always just gloss over this on the consent agenda. It occurs to me that if anyone in the public is interested, that we are once again approving a Williams report settlement, quarterly report that shows zero complaints. And in my experience on the board, I believe we have never had a Williams quarterly report that had a complaint. So I just, for purposes of the public's edification, if anyone is seeing this, that's what that is, that we have sufficient textbooks and materials, that our facilities are in good condition, that we have appropriate staff. And after noting that, I'll move approval then of item 10.01.
Second.
We have a motion by Mrs. Rogers, second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Anything for the advance agenda? Any reports by board members? Mr. Unger, then Ms. Frame.
Sure. Just a couple of, well, several things. First of all, I did attend the NSBA Board of Directors meeting and their annual education conference in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago. And I thought it was interesting because we heard several general session speakers. One was Sir Ken Robinson on student creativity. Another was a guy named Johnny C. Taylor, the president and CEO of the Society for Human Resource Management. And he talked about the need for STEAM-ready students who are cooperative and flexible. But the one that that was actually the most powerful speaker that I heard, and perhaps one of the most powerful speakers I've ever heard, was Michelle Gay. And I believe that she was one of the mothers that you heard, Mr. Pinkerton. She was the mother of a child who was murdered at Sandy Hook. And she talked about the need for school safety. She talked about, and I'm sure you heard this, that the best laid plans fall apart in a crisis. For example, the expectation that from the parents, why didn't the principal call me back? Why didn't the principal take care of things while the principal had been murdered? I mean, you can't think things through like that. You can't imagine this. I think one of the things that she reminded everybody in the audience was that we are all first responders, and I'm sure that's kind of what she ended with, and that we all need to be thinking about things like that. So it was a very powerful presentation, and I'm glad that I got to hear, and it sounds like you were too, Mr. Pinkerton. Just a couple of others, and I don't want to steal anybody's thunder, but Mrs. Roger and I visited C.L. Smith, where we witnessed the great work of our school nurses and the collaboration with school staff. Mrs. Frame and I met with teachers at Baywood Elementary School who shared their concerns about possible changes at the site. And then Mrs. Frame, Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, and I attended the Los Osos Rotary Morro Bay High School Scholarship Dinner. And I just want to note that it was our former board member, Mr. Yes. Quisenberry, who coordinated the event, and I think it went off without a hitch, and they made several thousand dollars, which will go to our Morro Bay High School students.
That's wonderful.
So,
all right, thank you, Ms. Frame, then Mr. Buckman.
I just wanted to give a shout out to the students at Morro Bay High School for the Mamma Mia performance. And I know Catherine and Dr. Prater, you saw that performance, one of the best performances, if not the best. And kudos to the staff and the students for an amazing production. So, amazing.
Mr. Buckman?
Thanks. I had the opportunity. I was appointed to the California School Boards Association Policy Platform Committee, and I had the opportunity to attend my first meeting. And I have to tell you, it was very intense. This small group sets the foundation and reviews prior platforms for all of CSBA's legislative action and other things that they do. And one of the things that stood out to me was the continual focus on equity. It was really outstanding.
Thank you. Dr. Eisenrath-Rogers?
I would just like to thank you, Mrs. Sheffer, and Mr. Buckman, for all the time you spend poring over our board policies that we just approved this evening, and the time that you take to edit and update those.
Fascinating.
Yes.
No, it actually has proven to be more interesting than I had imagined it might be.
I'm sure. Yeah. And I just wanted to mention that I attended a very unique parents' evening at San Luis Obispo High School. It was called What Students Wish Their Parents Understood About Them. And it made me really think hard about the education that I think our parents long for, and perhaps our students do as well, so that the parents understand more about what the students are actually going through at school and what is expected of them. And but it was just very extremely well done. The ladies who started Wellness Slow were participants in it, but mainly it was from our counselors at Slo High School who put this together, realizing that students, there was maybe a disconnect between what parents know and what students are actually experiencing when they first get to high school. So, yes, so that was quite well done.
Thank you. That's it for this evening. Where our next meeting is May 7th at J2. All right, at the district facilities. Thank you so much.